Two federal indictments handed down against associates of the president. How the process works and what happens next? Our legal expert weighs in just ahead. Good morning and happy November. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9. Also, you can always grab our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, local attorney Michael Stansky tells us about just what it takes to get a federal indictment and the next steps in the Russia probe. Get on the line now with your thoughts and comments at 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with international human rights activist and exiled Turkish journalist Sevgi as she speaks at WJCT Studios this evening. And this week is Veteran Small Business Week, all about the move to help veterans go into business for themselves. All of that and more ahead. But first, this hour on Monday, a grand jury handed down indictments against two of President Trump's advisors, Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, on numerous charges, including money laundering. It all comes out of the investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller into Russia's involvement into the 2016 election. Another former Trump aide, George Papadopoulos, has already pleaded guilty to lying to investigators and has testified the Trump campaign coordinated in some fashion with the Kremlin. What does all this mean? How does the indictment process work? What can we expect going forward from the special counsel? What are your questions about all this? Many Americans have them. To answer some of them, we welcome local attorney Michael Stansky, former Secret Service agent, and among other areas, his practice focuses on federal trial, appellate, and administrative law. He joins us in studio with the latest on the Russia probe. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments about Special Counsel Mueller's investigation and indictments as we talk about the Russia investigation right now on the show? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page. And Michael, it was not surprising that Paul Manafort was indicted. That, I think, was expected by many. What really sent the political and media world reeling was this other guy. Nobody expected this name to surface, George Papadopoulos. That was sort of the two in the 1-2 punch yesterday by Robert Mueller. They've got this guy already locked up. He's pleaded guilty, and he's put forth what looks like damning testimony when it comes to potential contacts between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. As you read through the indictment, and as we talk about the role of this former aide Papadopoulos, what were your initial thoughts?
I think my initial thoughts is this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think that there's a lot more information that's going to come out. I think that the Papadopoulos case is significant because he really didn't do anything wrong necessarily until he lied to agents. And so it's one of those cases where the cover-up is really worse than, you know, the underlying conduct itself.
The old Watergate saw, the cover-up is worse than the crime.
Absolutely.
All right. He lied to federal agents. So at that point, he's theirs. They can put him away for a very long time.
Absolutely.
So at that point, he starts cooperating.
Absolutely.
That's how these investigations tend to work. Based on what we know now and based on some of the language in this indictment, do you think it's likely that Papadopoulos has been wearing a wire, that they put a wire on this man and that they have more incriminating conversations between him and others in the Trump orbit?
I think that that's definitely a very real possibility. And I think one of the takeaways that your listeners should know is Bob Mueller's team, it is the A-team as far as a federal criminal law. Hands down, he's assembled the best prosecutors. He has probably been able to assemble the very best agents, and so they are going to use all of those tools. Once you have somebody cooperating, all of a sudden, your ability to extract information from that person and people around them grows exponentially. So this is, like I said, this is the tip of the iceberg, and even if he wasn't wearing a wire, the fact that, you know, he's going to provide emails, email addresses, telephones, all of that data is going to be analyzed, and it's going to be bounced against Manafort and Gates. So there's certainly a lot of work for them to do, and there's going to be more information coming out.
549-2937 to join us. And Mueller's mandate is to examine potential connections between people in the Trump campaign and Russians attempting to influence the 2016 election. We already know Russia worked very hard to try to influence the election. What we don't know is whether the Trump campaign formally coordinated with a hostile foreign power. We know Russia tried to infiltrate the Trump campaign. We don't know whether the Trump campaign worked hand in glove with Russia to bring about its desired end, a victory in the election. Now, as we look through the documents that were released, and you look through the emails that went back and forth between George Papadopoulos and others that he was in contact with, how incriminating are those emails?
I think that they're significant as much as the fact that it looks like there are use of cutout people, right? So obviously, you know, in any kind of major life event professionally, the principals are not going to contact each other, right? I mean, it's not how it works in any organization. And so they use lower-level folks that are going to talk to the other lower-level folks in the other organization, and then it levels up.
And, of course, Bob Mueller knows that.
Right?
So what's a special counsel, special prosecutor's strategy at this point as he tries to make the case stick, so to speak? Because, of course, the president and the men around him can say, well, this was a low-level person.
Right.
He was not acting on my authority. And whether or not that's true, we don't know. But, of course, that's what will probably happen as more evidence might be presented. So what's Mueller's strategy?
This is a classic federal criminal investigation. And this is what the feds do, is the low-level folks are arrested first. They flip. They provide information for the next person and then the next person until you've exhausted all avenues. So what Mueller's going to do is – and I really think that the major muscle move for Bob Mueller right now is Manafort, because Manafort is looking at some very significant time. He's looking at losing all of his assets for not only himself but his family, which is significant. And so he's going to make a deal. And – If I were the president or somebody around the president, I'd be concerned by that, because even if Paul Manafort does not give up anything incriminating against President Trump or anybody in the White House, there's going to be some type of dirty laundry that's going to be aired, because Manafort's not going to be given the option. He's going to be given a deal. If he lies on one piece of information, that deal is going to go away, and he's going to probably spend the rest of his life in prison.
President Trump, though, does have the power to pardon. What about that option?
And that is his prerogative. And you know, that's, we have three branches of government, and they can exercise their oversight if he decides to do that. However, at the end of the day, the information is likely to come out. And the other thing I want to just talk about, the actual indictment itself, indictments never contain all information, right? The indictments, as you read them online, on the docket, they're going to provide just enough information to get you into court. They're not going to provide everything. So you have to imagine that you are seeing a tiny sliver of the evidence and information out there. And the majority of it is with Bob Mueller, and he's planning his next move, who he needs to go after next, who needs to be heavily investigated or possibly indicted next.
A name that did not come up on Monday, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who, as we've learned over the last several months, has been a target of federal investigators. Based on what we know, do you think Mueller's team has flipped Michael Flynn?
He may very well have. And of course, it's very much a game of strategy, because if you do not have a lot of evidence on somebody, you don't want to show your hand, and a target of the investigation is able to go ahead and escape. So if he has, it's probably not revealed yet, but there's certainly a possibility, and there's certainly a possibility that Michael Flynn might have testified in front of the grand jury as well. So there's a number of investigative options, and like I said, this is a tiny sliver that we're seeing.
Also, a legal question for you. The word collusion has been thrown around a lot in recent months. You know, did the Trump people collude with Russia to swing the election? Did they manipulate data? Was there funny business on social media? We know there was, but did the Trump campaign play a part in that? Collusion in and of itself, not a crime under the strict interpretation of the law, correct? However, espionage is a crime, and it's a capital crime, isn't it?
Right.
Can you explain the difference between those two terms and what the law says?
Well, I think that when we start throwing out and we start talking about espionage, I think we kind of jumped the gun, because you look at all of these other investigations and the indictments so far, they are for relatively vanilla crimes. George Papadopoulos, 18 U.S.C. 1001, lying to a U.S. government official. Mm-hmm. So as this develops, you're going to see a lot more of those types of indictments. You're not going to see the grand espionage type charge. And a lot of it is going to do with the fact that we don't charge it that often, right?
It's unusual.
We don't have a history of it. So you're going to take the lowest fruit. And the lowest fruit is going to be those instances where folks have lied to the government, they have defrauded the government through their financial activities. So I think that that's going to be a heavy lift to make any type of major capital case on anybody. But who knows? It might happen.
So you're saying that, in your view, the Mueller team is trying to pursue an Al Capone tax evasion strategy against this administration?
That's absolutely it. And that's what you saw with the Manafort. And like I said, there could be more information. But the bottom line here is he was not arrested necessarily for a collusion with the Russians. It was very much a money laundering, an economic crime type investigation that he was captured on.
But again, help me understand this. Collusion in and of itself is not a crime.
No.
It's illegal technically, but you can't be arrested for it. What does the law say?
The law is going to lay out that those factual circumstances for you to deal with the foreign governments, okay? And so
you're not allowed to coordinate with a foreign government in the interest of winning an election. That's against the law.
Right. But it's going to come down to a lot of factual circumstances. And so you're going to have to see what is it that specifically people have done? And what is that straw that breaks the camel back from their just exercising research or due diligence or policy advising to breaking it so that we are in a situation where there is absolutely collusion? And it becomes very difficult when you have these cutout folks, when you're not directly working with them, when it's the aide to the aide to the aide that's working with the aide to the aide to the aide for somebody else. That causes a problem. So that's why I think that you're definitely going to have some issues with those larger scale violations of law.
Let's go to your calls now for Jacksonville attorney Mike Stansky. His specialty is federal trial, appellate, and administrative law. 549-2937. Chris is at the beaches right now. Hey, Chris, good morning to you. Happy November.
Thank you. You too, Melissa. I really called this wrong. I was guessing that Roger Stone would be one of the first people indicted because of...
You know, Chris, Roger Stone is in Twitter jail, but he's not in real jail. That's about it. They kicked him off Twitter the other day. But go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I didn't know that. In any event, I mean, given Roger Stone's announcements and then the release of the stolen emails, and they're still stolen, even if they're stolen from an unsecured server, I thought, well, there's easy pickings. The prosecutors will go after him right away. And they haven't. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or can shed any light on why they have not pursued who seems to be the easiest target.
Okay, thanks for that. Roger Stone, a Florida-based guy, a close associate of the president, and he admitted on Twitter some time ago that he had communicated with a Russian shadowy figure known as Guccifer 2.0, What about Roger Stone?
I don't agree that it's not the I don't agree that it's the easier target. I think Paul Manafort's financial dealings just leave such a huge paper trail, and it's just so easy to prove those types of violations.
What about the money trail? As we learned about Manafort moving hundreds of millions of dollars all over the world, money laundering charges that are quite eye-popping, frankly. What did you think about that? You've seen these types of cases before in your career, but what? So this was not new to you.
No.
These money laundering cases, are the feds deal with them all the time, but how does Manafort stack up to others you've seen?
I think that, I mean, honestly, it's relatively amateurish for somebody of his level of sophistication. I think that, you know, he is not by far the best money launderer that the United States has seen, and it shows. I mean, it shows in the fact that they were able to quickly identify those times that he had evaded reporting to the federal government on of his offshore transactions, and he really didn't do a very good job of it, and that's why he's in the boat that he's in right now.
And now let's talk about the fact that the president, through his spokesperson and himself as well, tweeting, saying these charges stem from activities that my former campaign chair engaged in years ago, and they do not implicate me. What about that argument?
It's a partially correct argument. I mean, it really is. However, like I said before, if your former coworker has been arrested – and he or a former employee has been arrested, and the federal government, the entire weight of the federal government is coming down on him, you're going to be concerned. It doesn't matter if it's the president of the United States or if it's you, Melissa. If the government is coming after somebody that's very close to you, there is going to be some airing of dirty laundry. And if it's an issue where the president has violated the law or not, that you know very well that the court of public opinion could be worse sometimes than the actual court of law. So I certainly think it's damage control, and I'm just definitely trying to deflect.
Meanwhile, top Senate Republicans this week are saying they're resisting calls for the president to fire special counsel Bob Mueller and saying they believe he needs to finish the job. Your reaction?
Bob Mueller has an outstanding reputation. If you were going to pick anybody else in this country, I don't think that there'd be anybody better to do it. He's a former director of the FBI. He's a former U.S. attorney. He knows the Department of Justice and the FBI better than probably most people in the country. So he's absolutely the right person to lead this investigation. These cases take a long time, and I can certainly understand from a political side of the House why they would want it to finish fast, because it's wrecking every single news cycle when somebody's trying to put something positive on. But if you want this to be done thorough and you want the American people to have no questions, then it needs to be done properly no matter how long it takes. So that's certainly a piece. The other thing that should be pointed out is Robert Mueller's investigation isn't the only one that's going on. I can only imagine that the White House is doing their own internal investigation, which, you know, it poses problems because they don't want necessarily to leave a paper trail. The Senate is conducting their investigations. I'm sure that some of the individual departments are conducting their own investigations as well. So it's not just Bob Mueller's investigation that's going on.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, let's take one more call for Jacksonville attorney Michael Stansky. As we discuss the latest in the Russia probe, Jason in San Marco. Go ahead, Jason.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
I wanted to say that I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, but the people in these type of instances, corporate and government malfeasance, at the very, very top, almost never go to jail or are brought charges upon them. And you only have to look at our governor to see a good example of that, where he was the chief executive officer of an enormous healthcare company that paid a fine of well over $1 billion, and yet Rick Scott walked scot-free. And if you look at the tops of the banks that were involved in the banking crisis and the financial meltdown and the mortgage collapse, the people at the top who were actually in charge of the companies never went to jail. The companies paid fines, but I don't think Donald Trump will ever be charged with a crime. I think the people underneath him will take the fall for him. And that's my opinion, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to state it.
All right, Jason, I'm sure many share that opinion. Meanwhile, as you said, Michael, this, you believe, is just round one.
Round one, tip of the iceberg.
We wait for more from the special counsel, who, by the way, can keep a secret.
Absolutely.
We didn't hear word one about this low-level figure until Monday. So we'll continue to follow the investigation. He is a valued legal contributor to this program, Jacksonville attorney Michael Stansky. Thank you for being on the show today.
I appreciate it, Melissa. My pleasure.
Much more still ahead later. It's Veterans Small Business Week, how you can start your own business and grow it with some local support if you're a veteran. But up next, a conversation with international human rights activist Sevgi, an exiled journalist from Turkey, where you can hear her speak tonight. That's next.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
When I saw my Uncle Dominic, he pointed to his gun and said, "If you bring shame to me or my family, I will shoot you and I will shoot Anthony."
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, a marriage opposed, a cop's unexpected duties, and trying to be friends with James Brown. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Hey, Car Talk fans. If you're wondering why Click and Clack aren't here, NPR is no longer distributing the best of Car Talk. The good news is you can continue to listen to the podcasts of the program at cartalk.com. We hope you enjoy WJCT's new weekend schedule. For more information about the new programs, visit wjct.org/weekends.
It's easy to listen to WJCT even when you're not near a radio. Just visit WJCTnews.org from your phone or tablet. On our mobile site, you're just one click away from a 24-hour live stream of our programming, and you'll also have easy access to all of the top local news stories. Listen live on WJCT's mobile website, WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back. This evening at WJCT Studios, a prominent journalist and human rights activist will tell the story of her ordeal and exile from her native land, Turkey. Sevgi Akar Çeşme is a Turkish journalist in exile. Last year, she was dismissed as editor-in-chief of Today's Zaman, an English daily publication in Turkey, as the increasingly dictatorial regime there has tightened its crackdown on press freedom and other basic human and civil rights. Global Jax, the Atlantic Institute, and the Istanbul Cultural Center are sponsoring tonight's reception at WJCT. It's called How Did Turkey Become the World's Largest Jail for Journalists? We have a preview right now as we're pleased to welcome Sevgi to Studio 5. Good morning and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Lots of interest in your talk tonight at WJCT. And so you were the editor of a newspaper there, an English language publication called Today's Zaman. And then you were let go from that position?
Correct. Actually, by the way, first of all, I'd like to start by condemning the terrorist attack in New York, and my heart goes out to people, the victims anywhere around the world, you know, who are affected by such violent acts. Yes, I was editor-in-chief of Today's Zaman. Before that, I worked for the same media group for about 5 years as a reporter, columnist for both the Turkish daily and the English version of it. And as a result of the increasing pressure against our newspaper and any critical newspaper in Turkey, following the corruption investigations of 2013 that is implicating President Erdogan, the government finally seized our newspaper in March 2016. And when, because the newspaper was confiscated on charges of terrorism, and I was one of the executives of the paper, it was pretty clear that sooner or later they would come after me. So I decided to flee Turkey. And I think it was the right decision to do, because even back then, Turkey was not a free country for journalists. And it became much and much worse since I left.
It has gotten worse.
Much worse.
It has become increasingly clear that the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, is an authoritarian dictator, that Turkey is no longer a democracy.
Unfortunately, it's true that Turkey has never been a complete, you know, institutionalized democracy. It always has been fragile. It was always difficult to be a journalist in Turkey, but it has at least some level of democracy, functioning democracy. But especially because of that corruption investigation, I think that's the gist of the matter. And I think listeners would like to maybe, I don't know, inform themselves a bit more about the corruption investigation, because that has repercussions in the United States as well. If you ask, I would be more than happy to answer. But basically, the crux of the matter is that President Erdogan has been avoiding accountability and silencing any form of opposition and criticism in the country.
Right. Silencing any critical journalism that looked into abuses of power
Exactly. Inside
his administration, his regime.
It started with that, and then it's been getting worse and worse. There is, especially following the alleged coup attempt of July 15, the crackdown gained pace, and several media outlets, if not hundreds, were shut down. So right now it's impossible to talk about a free and independent media outlets in Turkey. So in a way, people are blind and deaf when it comes to holding government accountable and when it comes to hearing facts, actually.
It must have been heartbreaking for you as a journalist to watch this process unfold in your own country.
Unfortunately, it's so heartbreaking because I'm witnessing my home country being ruined for the sake of protecting one family, if not one man. And it's been ruining in our very own eyes, unfortunately.
And Turkey has always been held up to the West as an example of a Middle Eastern country with freedoms, mm-hmm. press freedoms, mm-hmm. egalitarian mores, for the most part, for women. Other social and cultural freedoms mm-hmm. that those in the West see as important. Mm-hmm. And so what would you say to those here in this country listening now? They've been following these changes in Turkey, but they're not really familiar with the details of how the country has changed.
Sure.
How deeply has it changed?
Sure, it's so normal. It's, after all, it's one of the remote countries, and there are so many issues going on in the world, and I can only understand if people are not hearing too much, not only because of media pressure in Turkey, but because of complexity of the issues. Turkey, again, has always been imperfect, but at least it had some sort of hope for betterment. And in the initial years of this government, we just thought that the government was taking Turkey towards the European Union. And it's completely reversed.
And how much of that has to do with Vladimir Putin's Russia? We were talking about Russia in the first segment. Let's talk geopolitics mm-hmm, for a minute. Mm-hmm. Where's the hand of Russia in this, in your estimation, as a Middle Eastern journalist?
Mm-hmm. Right now, I mean, Russia has little to do with the ongoing purge in Turkey. But it's true that in terms of Turkey's relations, with neighboring countries, especially Syria and others. It's true that Erdogan has been approaching Russia more and more, especially following a crisis, because Turkey, in a nutshell, downed the Russian military jet a few years ago. And then because Russia imposed sanctions on Turkey, Erdogan chose to apologize and is becoming closer and closer with Russia, especially in the aftermath of the alleged coup attempt, because Turkey is moving away from NATO
from the
alliance,
EU, away
EU
from the NATO
and the
alliance.
Western alliance. That's true.
Yeah.
That's in a nutshell, you know, to, you know, as simple as
okay.
The listeners could understand.
All right. And so your talk tonight is titled, Why Turkey is the World's Largest Jail for That's Journalists. True. You're a journalist that was able to escape. Mm-hmm. But there are hundreds of journalists that are sitting in jails in Turkey right now, correct?
Exactly. It's not only, unfortunately, the pressure, the purge is not limited to journalists, but also human rights activists, women, housewives, including housewives, doctors, engineers, people from all walks of life who are deemed critical of the regime. So the purge is unprecedented and brutal. And on top of it, you know, the listeners might find it interesting that right now Turkey jails American citizens as well. There is an American pastor jailed in Turkey and accused of coup involvement, believe it or not. And he is accused of being having links to the Gulen movement, a Muslim social grassroots movement that is, you know, trying to promote education and dialogue in Turkey and outside. Right now, Turkey declared it as a terrorist organization and holds it responsible, I mean, allegedly responsible for the coup attempt. And right now, even Americans are accused of having links to this movement. And recently, three American staff, I mean, actually Turkish citizen staff of U.S. diplomatic missions in Turkey are under arrest. So that led to suspension of visas by the United States in Turkey for Turkish citizens. So Turkish citizens are already paying a high price of being silent in face of oppression.
When you look back on your ordeal, what advice would you have for Americans who might say, well, that's a faraway problem and we don't have these types of issues here in the West, here in this country?
I would disagree, because even though the degree of the problems change, the nature of the problems do not change, unfortunately. Even in established Western liberal democracies, it's disappointing and surprising to see that not many people are defending media freedoms and other constitutional rights as much as they should, and they do not take attacks against media freedom seriously. That was one of my mistakes, actually. You know, in retrospect, I kind of regret not taking Erdogan's attacks on free media and other critics seriously. For example, when he said that separation of powers was an obstacle in front of the government, I just thought that this was a remark coming from a somewhat ignorant politician, populist ignorant politician. I never thought that he actually meant it.
And now here you are. Are you living in Florida now?
No, I'm touring some southern states to raise awareness on the ongoing purge in Turkey, because right now around 700 babies are also in prisons of Turkey. So I'm doing my share to raise awareness about this ordeal of many people in Turkey. I am currently in the United States, but I prefer not to disclose
where you live, sure. Yeah. Well, we're so pleased to have you on the program, and it's a preview of your talk tonight in our building. Sevgi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
She's activist and journalist Sevgi Akar Çezme. And there are still seats available for tonight. Register to hear Sevgi's talk tonight at WJCT. Just visit globaljax.org. They're also having an international tasting event this Saturday at Unity Plaza. The flavors of a dozen different countries, food, wine, beer, cultural performances. Again, go to their website for more for tonight's event and the one this weekend, globaljax.org. Back in a moment.
Bridget Cambria was hired to counsel kids who had come to the U.S. seeking refuge. Instead,
I learned how to restrain children. I learned how to shackle children. I learned how to strip search children. All the things that you would find in a normal prison.
Why this country detains immigrant kids for months, even years. On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we ask the tough questions and we take no guff, not even, from NPR's own Terry Gross.
Is there something that you love that would surprise people to know?
Oh, well, it might be opera, because I surprise myself to know I like it.
Nobody here is surprised to know that you like opera.
Don't be bringing that nonsense around here. We have plenty of our own. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR. Saturday and Sunday mornings on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Welcome back. Well, she's a card-carrying member of the so-called sandwich generation, an American age between 40 to 60, who is both raising kids and also caring for an aging parent. One in eight Americans fits that category, and Jacksonville business owner Darlene Finch Kuhn is one of them. Now, her recent experience as a caregiver for her 80-year-old mother serves as a really brutal example of the challenges the sandwich generation faces. November is Long-Term Care Awareness Month, so to mark it, we want to spotlight Darlene's story, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And thanks so much for joining us. So you grew up in Jacksonville, but you left to raise a family, build a career, but then you started having to come back and forth to Jacksonville from Orlando because your mom and stepdad were getting on in years.
Yes.
And then things started, as so many families go through, things for your folks started to go south, right?
Right. They got sick in 2014 between Thanksgiving and Christmas. We saw them on Thanksgiving. They were feeling great. At Christmas, they both had the flu and begged me to help them by finding an assisted living facility for them. So I got very busy looking in both Orlando and Jacksonville, and then got a phone call from someone at their church saying they were feeling better and wondered why I was trying to put them in a nursing home.
And then things got even more interesting from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You descended into this nightmare that so many families experience. What were some of the hallmarks of that experience?
Well, one of the hallmarks was that as their age increased and their illnesses got worse, my mother had a profound hearing loss as well as leukemia and dementia, and my stepfather at 87 was getting ill with things like heart problems, back problems, stomach problems. So the visits to the doctors increased quite a bit. And that's typical of any aging parent situation. But I was living in Orlando, so there was a lot of flying back and forth up and down the road in my car to take care of them. And that isn't easy when you're
when you're not
in a family of your own.
Right.
Caring
for an aging parent remotely is difficult. Mm-hmm. You also had trouble accessing care that theoretically should be available.
Yes. There are wonderful places that will help coordinate care, especially here in Jacksonville. You have Elder Source, you have Aging True, you have lots of places that will help you. But the flaw in the system is that, especially if you're working with at-home care, whenever the aging parent goes into the hospital, the at-home health care stops and they have to be assessed again. And my husband and I say that my poor stepfather was assessed to death without getting a lot of help because my mother kept calling 911 every time he got seriously sick instead of going through the other channels. So he would be taken to the hospital and then have to be assessed again. And there are waiting lists at these places. You don't just
get care
the next day.
So the care would stop each time?
Each time.
What a nightmare.
It was. It was extremely frustrating.
Oh, my goodness. So after he passed away, you moved to Jacksonville to care for your mother till she passed.
Yes. We moved in May of this year, and my husband left his home of over 20 years, so he's the saint in the story.
And nice hubby.
He is. He's wonderful, and he was a great son-in-law. And I actually moved in. We moved near my mother, but then the last few weeks I moved in with her so that we had those, you know, precious days together. And
well,
I'm,
that's
I'm
a blessing at least. Mm-hmm. By the way, in the middle of all this, Darlene's first novel set in Jacksonville, it's called Sewing Holes. It was published last year.
Yes.
So you're a published author now. Mm-hmm. So yes. Pick up her book.
Thank you.
So based on your experience as a card-carrying member of the sandwich generation, if you could give people out there one piece of advice as they try to navigate this with their parents, what do you advise?
I would say start the conversation early, have it often, and find out what their wishes are and try to honor them. They took care of us when we were small and helped us along the way as young adults, and it's our turn now to show that love and loyalty and take care of them. But you have to do it in a practical way. And honoring their wishes. Atul Gawande has a wonderful book called Being Mortal that I recommend everyone read and then start that conversation right away. And the second thing, I know you asked for just one, but I do want to say start thinking about how you're going to manage your old age because it comes quickly and your kids will appreciate you taking care of things.
And you, Darlene, say this is something you need to set aside money for now. Long-term care insurance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It may be too late to get that for your parents, especially if they're ill, but most of us baby boomers are still in relative good health and are relatively youthful. My husband and I did that immediately once we started caring for my parents because we love our two girls very much and we don't want them to go through that.
What's a good age to start buying it, do you think?
Yesterday.
Yesterday. Now.
However old you were. The younger and healthier you are when you purchase long-term care insurance, the smaller your premiums will be. So like any kind of insurance, lock it in early, keep it up.
It will pay dividends later.
It will. The only thing cheaper than or more expensive than insurance is not having insurance.
Wow. Well, November is Long-Term Care Awareness Month, and you've got me thinking. I think I need to go and buy some. And my husband, too. We don't have it yet. So
I hope you will.
Yes. This is a timely reminder for so many of us, isn't it?
Yes.
Darlene Finch-Kuhn, November is Long-Term Care Awareness Month, and we wanted to share her compelling story. Also, pick up a copy of her book, Sewing Holes, set in Jacksonville, by the way. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And in a moment, this week is National Veterans Small Business Week. We're going to tell you, if you're a veteran, some tips on how to start, build, and grow your own business, how you can access the help of those who really are standing here around town and want to give you the help you need. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Should Me Too include men too? Kevin Spacey has apologized to actor Anthony Rapp for allegedly assaulting Rapp when he was just 14. Rapp says he felt compelled to speak out after high-profile women in Hollywood went public about sexual misconduct there. Protecting boys from harassment in entertainment and elsewhere, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Lindy West, who writes with anger and humor about misogynistic trolling, misogynistic comedy, sexual harassment, fat shaming, and women who benefit from feminism but don't embrace it. She confronted one of her trolls on an edition of This American Life. She recently started a weekly column for the New York Times, and her book Shrill is out in paperback. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Tax code, as we all know, is complicated. How, though, did it get that way?
People like to cheat, and they like to take advantage of the rules.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Loopholes, deductions, exemptions, oh my. That story, the rest of the day's business news, and the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. This week, A Prairie Home Companion will broadcast live from the San Diego Civic Theater with our special guests. Fantastic Negrito, comedian Maria Bamford will be there. My old friend Sean and Sarah from Nickel Creek. All of us will be there. I'll be there too, right? Madison Cunningham is joining me for some duets. We'll have our band, The First Call Radio Players, a bit of comedy from the Acting Company, and a brand new song of the week.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally of this hour, this week is National Veterans Small Business Week, a chance to promote ways veterans can start, build, and grow their business. There are events happening in town this week to help you do just that. Natalie Hall is an economic development specialist and veterans rep with the Small Business Administration local office, and she's here now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. And it is Small Business Week for veterans, and so you really want to get the word out to our large veteran population. What's happening this week?
So this week, as Melissa just mentioned, we are kicking off the National Veterans Small Business Week. So here in the Jacksonville area, the Small Business Administration, we're having a Let's Talk Money Lenders panel, which is going to take place Thursday, November the 2nd at the SBA North Florida District Office, which is at 7825 Bay Meadows Way in Jacksonville.
Okay. So this is a way veterans need to come to this to access information, tools that they can use.
Correct. So if there's, someone that's military connected as well as the spouses, we don't want to leave the spouses out, that has a business or considering starting a business, we just think this event is a perfect opportunity for those that need financing, because a lot of times, that's the area that they struggle the most, getting finance.
That's the biggest hurdle.
Correct.
And what's the track record with this program for helping veterans in the past get through this process?
So basically, we've been celebrating the National Veterans Small Business Week. This is the fourth year, okay? But the Small Business Administration, now we have in place a Veterans Business Outreach Center, which is best there for our veterans and spouses that want to start or grow a small business. The Small Business Administration has a Veterans Advantage loan product as well. And again, we have the other resource partners such as SCORE, Small Business Development Center, and the Women's Business Center, as well as the local SBA district office.
When veterans come back from serving and they transition from military culture to civilian culture, it can be a tough transition. Going into business rather than going to work for a major company, that can be an attractive option for a lot of veterans. But starting a business is tough for anybody, whether you've served or not. What are some of the other ways the SBA provides support?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that. So those individuals that are on their way to transition out, there is a program that we have which is called Booster Business. It's a two-day entrepreneurship track that we come directly to the military installations to deliver for those that want to take that training. It covers information as far as financing, creating a business plan, marketing, and additional other key factors that's going to help someone, start or grow a small business. And outside of that Booster Business program, we had one that's called Reboot. So outside of those two things, we also have a program which is called VWISE, which is Veteran Women Igniting the Spirit of Entrepreneurship. We also have Entrepreneur Bootcamp for Veterans. So we have a lot of things. Veterans are an initiative for this, with the Small Business Administration. I mean, those are things that's happening here in this area around the country. So it's not just here only in Jacksonville, Florida.
Sure. It is National Veterans Small Business Week. So if you missed the first part of Natalie's comments, can you tell people again time and place where they can access all of this?
Okay, so Thursday, which is tomorrow, November the 2nd, we are having our 2017 National Small Business Week event, which is going to be Let's Talk Money, Linda's panel, and it's going to take place 9 a.m. to 12 at the Small Business Administration's district office, which is located at 7825 Bay Meadows Way in Jacksonville, Florida.
Down there on the south side.
Yes.
All right. She's Natalie Hall, Economic Development Specialist and Veterans Representative with the SBA local office. It is National Veterans Small Business Week. If you're a veteran and you have an idea for a business, stop by tomorrow at 9 a.m. to their office. They are there to help you. And thanks, Natalie, so much for being with us.
And thanks for having us.
All right. That's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you miss a show, you can always get our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or our app. Next on 1A, why some of Hollywood's youngest victims stay silent about sexual abuses. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.